Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Welcome back to Two Judgy Girls. I'm Mary from the Bay.
And I'm Courtney from LA. TJG is the podcast where we spill all the tea on your favorite reality TV shows, celebrity gossip, and everything in between. We're here to bring you our unfiltered opinions, hilarious commentary, and plenty of laughs along the way.
We're two SDSU Delta Gamma sisters with a microphone and a whole lot of opinions. Each week, we dive headfirst into the wild world of reality television, from Bravo to all the trash TV you could want. We break down the drama, dissect the latest scandals, and share our thoughts on everything from the jaw-dropping moments to the embarrassing antics.
But that's not all. We're not here to just gossip. We're here to connect with you, the jurors, and share our love of all things pop culture. Whether we're dishing on the latest celebrity breakups, discussing our favorite guilty pleasure movies, or sharing embarrassing stories from our own lives, we promise to keep it real, keep it fun, and keep you coming back for more.
Come judge with us.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
The first day was one of the few days I drowned the canoe. The second it crests down and touches the bottom of this pool, it just completely fills with water and just goes straight underneath, is sunk.
Welcome to the Adventure Podcast and this episode with Robert Lester. Rob is an outdoorsman with a lot of strings to his bow. He's a climber and a skier, but this episode avoids those activities almost entirely. In 2023, Rob and his completely inexperienced cousin Braxton decided to canoe 1,300 miles down the Columbia River. I was really drawn to this story, particularly the idea that two people with very little knowledge of an adventurous activity could plan and undertake such a long and seemingly serious journey. In this conversation, we talk about the whole process. Why do this? What was the motivation? How did you plan it? And of course, what actually happened? But we also talk about some bigger picture stuff. Rob's fascination with the changing landscape around them and the environmental and conservation elements of their expedition are fascinating. I also want to very briefly mention we've now launched the Adventure Podcast Plus, where free subscribers get access to a newsletter that features links, insights and opinions on the worlds of adventure and exploration. Paid subscribers get access to a whole load of new bonus content, including a monthly Q&A with a guest, access to filmed InVision podcasts, access to our shorter form podcast, The Dispatches, and subscriber-only posts and articles. To get involved, head to theadventurepodcast.substack.com. And finally, before we start, I'll just give a huge shout out to the Martin Moran Foundation, our charitable partner, who help people from disadvantaged backgrounds get outdoors, upskill, and fall in love with mountains. If you're in a position to, please consider donating to the foundation. Okay, over to Robert Lester. So thanks for doing this, man. Let's start at the start. Feels like a logical place. If you could tell me who you are and what you do.
Yeah, so my name's Robert Lester. Generally, I consider myself a skier and a climber and a mountaineer. But really, you know, I'm just a person who loves the outdoors, who loves adventure, anything like that.
And I think it doesn't come as any surprise. I'm kind of here to talk to you a bit about your huge canoe project. If you could tell us a bit about what that was and where the idea for it came from.
Yeah, so originally, I had the idea first when I was a little kid. And what the project was canoeing from the headwaters, one of the sets of headwaters of the Columbia River. So basically from the Continental Divide all the way to the Pacific Ocean. And I originally had the idea when I was a little kid, we used to build boats, me and my cousins, and we'd float them down the river. And I loved the idea that this river was connected all the way to the ocean, and that other, you know, other people in the past used to use these like highways, and that it was still possible. And really, it was something that I had always wanted to do, but something that I kind of didn't focus on much. Occasionally, when I'd get bored in college classes, I'd map the route or do some of the planning if I didn't enjoy the class I was in. And then I still had it, you know, kind of on the shelf, didn't really necessarily ever plan on doing it, but it was something that I had always really wanted to do. And I guess two Octobers ago now, I was talking to a friend of mine. He's a kid who's a quadriplegic. His name's Ty Stosich. And he's incredibly inspiring to me. I've known him for like probably close to 15 years now. And he has just the most infectious positive attitude, the most inspiring person I've ever met. And when I told him about this idea that I always had, he got so incredibly excited about it. And to me, when somebody who I look up to so much was so excited about an idea, I felt like it was, you know, my responsibility to make it happen.
Yeah, that's so cool. I mean, it goes from that, like, oh, I've got this dream, but I'm probably never going to do it, to, oh, God, now I've got to do this thing. I kind of have to do it.
Yeah, exactly. And from there, you know, it went to me from going home that night, having dinner with him, to, you know, trying to call canoe companies. Because I have, you know, some relationships with some outdoor companies, but I'm generally not known for my skills as a canoer. So it began to get to this point of like, you know, I'm going to need a really nice high-performance canoe to be able to get through this. And yeah, so that's where it went from there, making calls and trying to see if I could convince anybody to take a chance that we were going to make it.
And?
We did. We ended up with, it took a few months, but we ended up with a great partner. They built a custom canoe for us. The company's name's Navarro Canoes, and they were great. They built it in the Midwest and shipped it all the way out to Montana for us, and it ended up being exceptional. And I, you know, I don't know that much about canoes when I started, but by the end, I could tell you it was like the Ferrari of canoes.
So hang on, let me just get my head around this, right? So you sound like you don't have much canoe experience.
Correct.
And your friend is a quadriplegic.
Yep.
And you decide to go and canoe 1,200 miles.
Well, and so he didn't join on the trip. He was the inspiration for the trip.
Okay.
But I had a few partners lined up, but they ended up falling out last minute. And the kid who joined me, Braxton Mitchell, had never been in a canoe before.
Now he has.
Yeah, he, you know, and he's actually from Salt Lake and not a big outdoors person. He was more of a, you know, loves car culture and, you know, has went camping and things like that, but never an adventure anywhere near this sort.
So I kind of feel like we need to break it down into like, you know, because I've met a lot of people and done a lot of things where you kind of go, okay, we're going to go and do this thing, and now we're going to spend a really long time planning it and making it all work. And it's clear that you've got like a lot of high-end outdoor skills, so you're used to that side of things. But what did it feel like, and what did you actually do when it came to planning this journey and making sure it was actually doable?
So the biggest thing was route planning, you know, like making sure that we were going to be on routes where we were safe the whole time and making sure, you know, we had an idea of the portages around the dam, portages around big rapid sections that a canoe wouldn't be able to handle. And like I said, the nice thing was I had actually done a lot of that work like through my time in college. And when I was sitting in, I remember a lot of it was in this physics class that I always enjoyed physics, but I didn't enjoy necessarily the lectures in the class. But I was in there, and I remember I'd just be on Google Earth really getting my like route planned for this trip that I really never thought was going to happen. And to be able to open up that those like files that I still had saved was like a great resource and actually saved a lot of time. And from there, you know, it was just a lot about making it happen. And, you know, it was a different thing too, because, you know, in the skiing and climbing world, you know, we track our approach generally, and then we have a pretty great idea of what the ascent or the descent is going to look like. But this was so long, you know, 1,300 miles, that a lot of times it had to be kind of, you know, when we come around the next corner, what are we going to find? What's different from what I thought was there? And that sort of thing.
I mean, I wonder if the best way to approach this next bit is like to just ask you to tell me the story. You know, let's get the campfire out and, you know, what happened on this journey? Take as long as you need.
Yeah. So we had a lot, you know. It's like, it was 52 days total. Like I said, 1,300 miles. It wasn't a self-supported trip. I always joke that if it was, you know, even 6 months after we finished now, I'd still be out there. I'd still be paddling across if I had to walk to every town and pick up our own food and bring it back. But, you know, really, we started, you know, in these creeks that are only feet wide, you know, and feet deep. And we had to leave at absolute high water because otherwise we can't even get down it. Even with that, you know, we're ending up walking in the river with the canoe, pulling it down, you know, that sort of thing, swimming with it in deep holes, trying to hop in when we had straight stretches. Go from that to getting a little more depth. But, you know, we have a 17-foot canoe and we'd have like 12-foot turn radiuses. So it was impossible to keep us off like the banks and out of the willows. So we went from walking to really just getting beat up by the willows and things like that. Trying to preserve this canoe too, you know, like I know it's what's going to keep us out there for, I was hoping 40 days when we started, but ended up, you know, like I said, being a bit longer than that, but really trying to preserve the canoe. Went from that to all of a sudden being in fast water where we're avoiding, you know, snags and strainers and some of the dangers of the river. And then you start getting to the damming sections. You go from that to all of a sudden, you know, where you've been stressed avoiding fast water and avoiding trying to get caught up in some of these really dangerous strainers, to 10 hours of flat water paddling a day and portaging around dams, carrying the canoe. And then we kind of hit the Columbia River Gorge section at the end. This is like one of the windiest places in the world. It's like where windsurfing was invented. And we end up then kind of transitioning to use some strategies to try and avoid the wind and the waves, whether it was paddling at night, or for us, it ended up just being walking, portaging, you know, like so those sections, there's not much known about the early section that we did, but a lot of people have done the like true Columbia from Canada down. And so the gorge is like a known area where it's going to be windy. It's going to be, you know, going to be a struggle with the wind. And a lot of people talked about just waiting, you know, long periods of time, whether it's a week or 2 weeks till the wind went down and they had opportunities. But that wasn't something that sat with me very well. I have to keep going if I can, you know, and like the idea that we could churn out 7 or 10 or 12 miles. And then the next time we didn't have a windy day, we could hopefully get a chunk of 40 in and keep moving was something that I was all about. So that ended up being our way to, you know, avoid these 4-foot rolling waves coming upstream was to get out and walk.
So that's there's a few different things I kind of want to talk about. I suppose the first is like the first few days. So you're canoeing with kind of limited experience, but some, your friend has never been in a canoe before. Like, how did you guys find it and how did you get on?
Well, so like I said, the very first few days end up more walking than anything else. And I have pretty limited canoe experience, but I have been on water a few different times and done some of that stuff, more mostly on a raft, right? And done some like multi-day rafting. But we did practice a bit beforehand, right? We got in the canoe on the days leading up to our actual departure date in some of the bigger rivers and are doing practice laps, getting ready, you know, making sure that I'm teaching this kid how to canoe, Raxton, how to canoe, and what end up being his, you know, his responsibilities from the front of the canoe. But then when we first get in, it actually ends up being more like walking, and then more in the sections we're getting in, trying not to bash off rocks. And, you know, I ended up like on the first day a few times taking some like chances. I'm like, okay, we can like run this little section. It's straight, not too bad. And then we got some like early gouges and I got nervous. I'm telling you, I was like, there's no way if I beat the hell out of this thing on day one that our canoe is going to make it all the way to the ocean. Like we're 30 miles in, you know, we have 1300 to go still. So
yeah,
it really, yeah, go ahead.
I was just going to say, I think like when we picture canoeing, I think we often think of like this really slow, gentle activity. And in some ways it feels like that, right? Like it's a gentle, beautiful way to travel on water, but you can cover distance fast. It's not the same as walking.
No, exactly. And like we even had some, you know, we had some days where we would choose to paddle long and cover distance fast. But if we had good current, you know, we did a few days where we did, you know, 70 miles easily with current. And then we did a few days where we'd push hard and cover 70 miles, but it was a struggle. So the current makes all the difference in terms of your speed and even ease of travel.
Yeah, but the walking sections at the start, I mean, they must have been really testing. And I think I'm curious as to, like, you said your friend, he's not particularly outdoorsy, likes car culture. How did he react to the whole thing when suddenly he's not canoeing, he's just walking down a river?
Yeah, so later I actually found out, I didn't find out till the end, but day two was, he told me later, was the closest he was ever to quitting. He figured on day two that he could still walk out to the highway and call somebody who had watched him like send off, and he'd be able to have them come get him a ride and leave. And the reason actually was because we were going through dealing with all these beaver dams early. So we'd be able to canoe some, but then walking in the river is actually a lot easier than, you know, hauling the stuff on land. So the river is also in flood stage, right? Because we need it to be in order to be able to even travel this thing at all. It's so small. And we'd reach these probably 15 or so beaver dams, and the river swells way up behind the beaver dam, right? And we have to go around it, and that ends up walking on land and usually walking through, like, you know, a field that has had cattle in it. So it's just full of cattle droppings with about 2 inches of water in it. And it was raining, and it was the coldest day of the trip was the second day. And we actually had really good luck with weather. But on that second day, we're going around barbed wire fences that are across the river, and we're going around these beaver dams. And it was pretty miserable.
Yeah, I think like often people picture these, maybe if you were, when you were a kid or whatever, like tell me if I'm wrong, but you picture these adventures as like Indiana Jones, right? Like we're just going to canoe like heroes through this gorge. The realities of it are sometimes barbed wire fences and cow poo.
Exactly. And, you know, just like anything, any type 2 fun journey, the struggle is what makes it worth it. But in the moment, the struggle isn't what's the fun part, you know? You're like, you remember the struggle, and it's what makes it memorable and makes any sort of expedition or trip great. But in the moment, you'd really wish that you weren't having the struggles that you're having.
Yeah, sure. So let's talk a little bit about like camp life in a way. Like I'm always, you know, having been on a lot of expeditions, fascinated by that side of things because I love it. Were you comfortable? Were you like taking minimal kit? What were you doing with your evenings?
Yeah, so different sections were a little different because, like I said, it was a partially supported journey. So we always were hauling our own camp gear. And with the exception of, again, the first, actually, I'll go into some. First day was one of the few days I drowned the canoe. We flipped it one other time, but I was pretty sure we were going to flip it in this set of rapids that we ran the other time. So I took all the gear out beforehand. On the first day, I was walking it, and there was this little like 3-foot drop down the river. And the river at that point is probably only 4 feet wide. So it really narrows into this little funnel, little drop. And I decided, man, instead of us walking it on the outside of the river over this, you know, kind of rocky, nasty terrain in this canyon, instead we'll just get the ropes out and we'll lower it down. So lower it over. And the second it crests down and touches the bottom of this pool, it just completely fills with water and just goes straight underneath, is sunk. We had airbags in it, you know, so that keeps it from going all the way to the bottom. But I, you know, it took us probably 15 minutes of this thing just getting pummeled by the water to figure out how I was going to get it out of there. And it ended up being no other way but me jumping in and grabbing it and trying to swim it out. But that was day one, and we drowned all of our camp gear. Everything was wet for the next week before we finally got it dried out. But besides that, we had really good luck of, you know, having our camp gear dry. At different points, we actually met with some people who had reached out to us, had heard about the journey, and we were able to stay with them at their houses. They'd like offer us, you know, dinner and a place to stay. And those were always really bright points of like, you know, getting a shower and a bed was amazing. And then there were other points where, you know, we would have our team who's resupplying us come, and therefore we could sleep on the cots and have the bigger tent and not the stuff we were hauling. So every day was a bit different. But as far as camp life, the best part was really just always getting to camp along the river for that many days and have that much beautiful terrain. All these campsites are just stunning places, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, I think it's incredible, that kind of landscape. And, you know, I've not been there, but how wild is it?
Well, and so that's the other thing, right? It's a really interesting, I guess, to use the word expedition with this trip, because it's as much of a distance journey as it is, probably more so than a wilderness journey. Because we're going through, you know, populated areas at times. We're going through towns, you know. There's times when the highway is within walking distance or sometimes rock throwing distance, you know. Like, so it's really an interesting deal from that point that we would go through cities and we would go through large spaces where there was nobody around us, nowhere near. So it was really kind of an interesting mix of that sort of thing.
Yeah, I want to get into all that stuff in detail because I think it links to a lot of the other reason to go and the things to highlight. But let's talk a bit about portaging. And I think, you know, maybe there's lots of people listening to this who don't know what that means. But if you could describe it to us, but also talk us through the process of doing it, because it is involved and it does take a lot of time. And I'd imagine it was a pain to have to do it so much.
So what portaging is it means, you know, that there's some sort of impediment in the river, whether it's a dam or whether it's rapids we don't feel like we can cross, etc. And what we do is we take the canoe out of the water and we walk it. Like, it's really that simple. Tell there's a spot where we can safely put it back in, where we're past the impediment and we can get back to canoeing. It's funny, I always said that some of these portages I'd walk 5 times, some of them I only had to walk 3 times, and other ones I just had to walk once. And that's like the best, and most of them were we luckily only had to walk once, especially the longer ones. But sometimes we'd see something downriver. It's Braxton's job. One of his jobs in the front of the canoe is to always keep his eyes out downriver. Like I said, we have a route plan, but we don't know what might be around the next corner, especially at this level of high water we were going, where, you know, you might come across anything. And so we come across the corner, we see something we don't like, pull to the side. I'd usually walk it and decide if we were going to portage it and what our portage route would be. Usually we would. I'd come back, I'd grab, you know, we'd grab the stuff, we'd walk most of our gear to where we were going to put back into the river. And then we would walk back to grab the canoe, hoist it on our shoulders, and walk it the rest of the way.
I think I'm just going to go back again. Like, why did you pick him?
Well, like I said, so the really cool part about the expedition and the story, the most rewarding part for me ends up being that watching Braxton get to grow into truly a man and just grow as a person. He turned 19 on the trip and just not a person who had been exposed to this sort of thing. And I had had these other two people at different points who I were pretty sure were going to come. The one kid had been planned for a long time to join us and then had a last minute issue. I thought I had a replacement and he had a reason that he couldn't go. And then, you know, I'm like, honestly, maybe 2 weeks away from our departure date. And I am, as they say, up a creek without a paddle. And we were actually at a family reunion. Braxton's my cousin. And I'm talking, going, telling, you know, they're asking who my partner is, what the journey's going to look like. And I'm telling them, I'm kind of in trouble here. And Braxton comes up to me and goes, I'll go. And, you know, I said, are you sure? You know, and tried to tell him about how this was going to be the hardest thing he had ever done and really describe those sort of things. And he was in. And then besides the second day, he never even considered quitting. So
that's so cool. Like I think sometimes when I ask those questions, I think like people might think I know the answer because I've done so much research, but I'm really conscious to, like, not over research and really ask the questions. And like, I had no idea. Like, what an amazing thing to do and what an amazing thing to give to somebody, essentially.
Man, and he really, you know, he really saved me. So it was cool for him to give me his time. And I really felt that I could give him not just this experience, but a lot of skills in life that, you know, I think people who have never done type 2 fun activities ever really get. A lot of people don't understand the skills and the drive and, you know, knowing what is in you personally. A lot of people don't always get those opportunities to learn that stuff about themselves. And so I really was excited that it was kind of a trade, you know, like he's giving me his time and his effort and I'm giving him this experience and the rewards that will come with it.
That's such a lovely way to look at it. Yeah, I think it's great. And has it, obviously it's changed him, like you've said that, but do you think it's turned him into an outdoorsman in many ways or any ways?
I don't know that it turned him into an outdoorsman, but it really truly gave him an understanding and a value for nature. And I think he will forever be like a, you know, maybe more of a recreationalist outdoorsman. You know, he picked up learning to fish and a love of the water and things that he didn't have, non-motorized travel, hiking, and things like that, that I think will probably forever be part of his life.
Yeah, that's so cool. There's so many different places I could go with this. So let's talk a bit about the journey downriver, as it were. Like you mentioned, you know, you're passing, you know, the highways, like going on bridges over the top of you or whatever. Was there a wider point to your journey other than you going on an expedition and having fun?
Yeah. So after Ty had told me, you know, that this was something that was valuable to me and something that I was going to do, I felt that it was really necessary that we don't just make it about ourselves, that we try to have some sort of positive impact. And so what I decided on was threefold, really. It was about trying to educate people about the health of the river, especially with regards to natural resource extraction. Where we started, where I'm from in Butte, Montana, is actually like the largest Superfund site. It's one of these areas where at one point, a third of all the copper in the world was coming from Butte. And so now we have the consequences from that era. The creek we started in at one point, they put over 1,000 tons of mining waste into every single day. in 1900. So that creek has now been remediated, but the destruction of a lot of this landscape was complete and total. And so we've, like, parts have been remediated and there's been a lot of good done, but there's also a lot that still needs to be done as far as cleanup in that area and in other areas along the river. And so that was really our first goal. Our second goal was to try and educate people about the importance of the Columbia River Basin, especially to indigenous peoples. And really that's Salish and Salish speaking people in this case. You know, a lot of areas along this river were not just their land, but incredibly powerful places. And some of them, you know, still are incredibly powerful places today. And then our third one was kind of to evaluate damming. And, you know, that's a tricky issue. You know, we're in a world where we are currently looking for as much clean energy as possible. Is damming clean energy, you know? And the idea of some of these dams state, you know, some of them operate at a really high level, putting out unbelievable amounts of electricity every day. And other ones are, you know, nearly dilapidated and ineffective and inefficient. So those were kind of what we chose to do as our topics of impact, of influence. This trip was going to be big, I knew. So I knew that it wasn't going to be about me or us. It was really going to be about trying to have some sort of impact.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Yeah, and I think I often talk, it's important to say, like, adventure for adventure's sake is totally fine and cool, particularly the small stuff and the short stuff. But I think increasingly we're seeing this push for, like, longer journeys, bigger expeditions, particularly, like, overseas and far away expeditions. Like, you started from home, basically. That's a different thing, but to have this bigger impact. And again, that's a controversial kind of subject that could take up an hour of our time, but I think you can do both. I think it's amazing that you decided to do something that was bigger than you. In what way, if at all, do you think that changed your experience of that journey?
Well, really, like, for me, it just gave me so much more knowledge. This is an area that I live in. You know, like I said, I even lived in the area where I knew some of these things about my own town's history. But the knowledge of what's happening to this river system that, you know, runs through the heart of our country, and also, like, the work that people are doing, I think it's really important that I'm just bringing awareness, you know, to other people's work. I'm not out there doing any of this conservation work that a lot of these people we talked to along our journey were doing. We really tried to make an effort to meet people where they were working on the river as we went downstream and talk to them in their expertise, both on, you know, their issues and the area. But those are the people doing the hard work, you know, out there trying to help the health of the river, help the future of all types of people who live around this river basin, or people who want to experience the river basin. And they're doing the hard work. We're just really bringing the knowledge to other people. We're trying to distribute their work. But for me personally, it was just about all the incredible knowledge I gained. You know, I get to talk to all these experts in this field who are so passionate about the river, about the river health, and, you know, whether it's fish species or ecological disasters or damming, there's so much that people are passionate about, knowledgeable about, and so much they have to share if you want to go, you know, look for it.
Yeah, totally. I think there's, like, this might be over the top, but I think maybe you start to transition like into explorer mode in a good way. It's like you're searching for something deeper than just going on your own journey. And I think that's, you know, I kind of hinted at it before, like it's a useful thing to do and maybe ethically it's a good thing to do. But actually, and I'm so glad you kind of alluded to it, like it can add a massive amount to an expedition or a journey. Like rather than just canoeing all day, every day, enjoying the natural world, you're finding things out, you're talking to people, you're learning, you're discovering. And like, it kind of makes the journey better in a way.
Yeah. And, you know, I thought it was cool too, because these people know a section of river far better than I ever will. But I know maybe more generally about the, you know, the length, what's upstream of them, what, you know, is miles and miles upstream of them, and, you know, how things that are happening up there might be having an impact on their situations and their issues. And in addition, you know, like talk about breaking up an expedition, you know, being able to talk to these people. I love my time in the outdoors, but sometimes paddling for 4 days on flat water without stopping and talking to these people or learning something is a bit monotonous. So when you got these opportunities, it was like a little gem that you could think about for the next, you know, 2 days while you paddled.
Yeah, sure. How did you, again, I'm jumping around all over the place here, but I'm genuinely fascinated by it all. You say like you had to pass through some dams. Yeah. You're talking like big dams.
Yeah. Including the biggest dam in the United States.
Well, so how do you portage around one of those?
So actually the huge dams are some of the better ones to portage around because people, you know, often come to those areas. You know, there's a lot of infrastructure around. So there's like, you know, there's a set portage route. Beforehand, there's a boat takeout. You know, there's usually sidewalks or something where we can meander down and then put in at the boat takeout below. The ones that were tough were the ones that people never came to. You know, nobody paddles through these sections, other sections. So we'd come and we'd talk to somebody at the dam, pull out right above the dam and ask, oh, where's the best place for us to put back in? You know, I have an idea from my map of where we might go, route planning, but what do you recommend? And it was always funny. We'd almost always get, well, you know, 15 miles down the road, there's a spot, real nice boat ramp you'll be able to put right in. And it's like, yeah, you know, we could walk for 15 miles or we could find a way to scramble over some rocks and through some bushes and down some hills and get her in the water a lot quicker. So it was really funny because it was hard for these people to grasp, even though that we came from so far, that we weren't just going to throw the canoe in the back of the truck and bring it to the next spot and take it out, you know, like despite being a supported journey, it was really important for us that we did all the downriver movement and then the canoe moved downriver through only river power or human power.
Yeah, I really like how honest you are about the supported, non-supported thing, because I think particularly in the adventure world, we get so hooked up with this stuff. And of course, in some senses, it matters. Like if you're looking at polar travel or climbing or whatever, or traverses, like, yeah, it matters. Of course it does. But it only matters because we think it does. And like, if you decide like my ethics for this trip are, I am going to have resupplies and I am going for a pizza when we get to that town because I really want one. Like that's great and that's cool. And I think creating these contrived journeys where you pass the pizza place that does really good craft beer and you're not going to go because you're a purist, okay, good for you, but that doesn't mean your journey is lesser because of that. In what way do you think it changed your journey, you know, for the better or the worse?
Well, I think, you know, it really is a cool, I don't know if the word you'd use would be Americana, right? Like we have a much better pulse on the river, but we also got to, you know, meet these cool people and, you know, see what, like you said, a little pizza joint or a little bar is like. And for me, it was almost kind of a no-brainer. I don't know, you know, like I said, my background's in, you know, climbing and mountaineering, where you get to the top and there is no craft beer place. You never pass one all day long. You get your craft beer when you get back home, you know? That's when you get to the bar. For this, it was like really hard for me to be like, okay, I'm going to go through the city of Missoula or the city of Portland later, you know, bigger cities. And I'm going to like pass it by and not park and go up there. Like that's, you know, I guess it just didn't really register to me. To me, it was like a benefit of this style of trip is like, we're passing these places. This is something I don't get to do. You know, I might as well go make sure I enjoy it.
Yeah. I mean, I'm trying not to overdo this in this conversation, but I think it's such a great message for people to hear, right? Because we often, like, whether it's on Instagram or reading like trip reports or seeing other expeditions, and we're like, oh, but you know, they did 100 days and they carried all their stuff and it was looks like so hard and I can't do things like that because of all these reasons. It's like, yeah, they did do that. And it was hard and they suffered and it was type 2 fun and they probably thought it was a brilliant trip, but like, we don't have to do that.
Yeah. And you know, with the exception of, you know, if you are trying to have an impact, like we talked about before, with the exception of that, these journeys are a lot for yourself. And, you know, you said you can decide your own ethics, you know, decide your own ethics and stick to them as you choose. You know, if you decide what you're going to do before you leave, yes, you should stick to that. But that doesn't mean it has to be the same as someone else's ethics. I think, you know, the trip I took could be incredibly valuable for someone who wanted to put the canoe in a truck for portages and drive. Like, that would be an incredible trip still. You know, you would still get so much value out of it for yourself. You would still get so much value for your soul of being in nature. You know, there's nothing wrong with how anyone wants to do their journey.
Yeah, no, totally. And in what way do you think, you know, short journeys and long journeys can be very different? Like going canoeing for 3 days over a long weekend is an amazing thing to do. You're going to have a brilliant experience, but it's that, like, you talked about the monotony. You know, on a 2-day journey, you probably aren't going to hit the monotony that hard. Like, you know, your time is limited. You've chosen to be there 52 days of straight paddling. You know, how was it different being out there for so long? And did you expect it to be like that?
Yeah, you know, I did really expect it. I think the tough part for me was less about the length in terms of like whether it was going to be 40 or 60 days, but that there's a set destination, but no set time. You know, we don't get to 40 days and it's over. You know, we passed, I was hoping if we did about 30 miles every day, we would have finished in like 40 days, 42 days, somewhere around there. When you pass that 40-day mark and you still have miles to go, that was more tough than necessarily dealing with the monotony or dealing with how long you had left. It was the uncertainty of how long you had left. And that's the point when we're hitting these sections where we're walking day after day or only getting to paddle for like, you know, 3 hours a day in the middle of the night instead of being able to, you know, put in 12-hour days and grind it through. Instead, you're having to like pick and choose and you're watching the days pass by you. And there was your goal of 40 days and you pass that. And you have to keep that same stoke, that same energy and push till you get to the finish. You know, the destination is the ocean, not the number of days you're out there.
Yeah, and I think there's so many different ways to react to that, aren't there? Like, you could be like, oh, great, I get 10 more days of being out here. Or, you know, I really wanted 40 and we're now at 43 and we've still got a way to go. Like, are you competitive with yourself?
Yeah, very. So for me, like, I'm super goal-driven, you know? Like, it's something in mountaineering that is something that you really have to check, right? You know, you have to make sure that you're not being too dangerous and making too risky of choices for your own safety. But in this case, it was, you know, it was proving myself right or just being competitive within myself, less in terms of, you know, whether the choice is risky or not, and more in the choice of like, this is what I set, like, let's make it. And that is something that is, you know, kind of a characteristic for me. I talked to, at the end of the trip, my father said something that was really interesting is he said, he was never worried that I would quit. He was worried that I would work us to exhaustion or to kill ourselves, you know, trying to get it done. And so I took that as a great compliment because that's something that, you know, I try to promote within myself, you know, maybe not to the extreme that he was mentioning, but this idea that, you know, I want to push myself to be the best that I can be.
Yeah, sure. And I guess it's a different dynamic when you've got your cousin with you who doesn't maybe have the same headspace as you or didn't. Like, you're not just pushing forwards for yourself and you're not just checking in with your own fatigue, etc.
Yeah, especially early on, you know, before he got this level of both fitness and this level of mental toughness. You know, we came early on to a day where we knew it'd be the portage. I planned it being the biggest portage of the trip. It was going to be like 18 miles. It's around a big set of rapids known as the Alberton Gorge. And like, especially at the conditions we were in, like these rapids are raft eaters, like let alone a canoe. You know, this canoe is incredibly high performance for paddling, but it's not a true whitewater canoe. You know, it's 17 feet long. It's more about its glide capabilities and its speed than it is about its pure stability, you know? So we have to be pretty careful when it comes to like rapid situations. And these are like some of the biggest water in the Northwest, the biggest for sure in Montana. So I know we have to walk a big section of this. And I had planned on hopefully like putting in between the rapids and like running little sections, pull out, walk the rapids. But I knew it'd be a lot of walking. But what it ended up was walking the whole thing. It was so high that like the flow was so high, you know, that it was way above where most people would take a whitewater kayak. Like it was, you know, true flood stages. Like this thing is ripping. It would have ate our canoe in a minute. So I decided that it was far too risky to be popping into the river in between these rapids, because if we mess something up, we're going to be heading through them, you know, and we won't be pulling out of the river for the next 18 miles till we're in a good spot where we can swim. So decided it was just way too risky. And, you know, I had told Braxton that this trip would be the hardest thing he'd ever done when he first, you know, asked me about going. And I specifically had this like day in mind. You know, I knew that if we walked the whole thing, that it would be a tough day of carrying this canoe, like incredibly tough. And I had myself like in the right mindset for this day for months. You know, I thought this is going to be the hardest day of this whole trip. You know, it's going to be the hardest thing I've ever done. It's going to be harder than climbing Rainier or, you know, one of these big adventures that I've done in the past. And the funny thing is like how much, you know, mental fitness really plays into a journey like this. So we get to this day, I'm preparing, you know, for the worst day of my life. We're walking with a canoe. It's heavy. It's miserable. But, you know, like I'm like kind of chipper. We're on like relatively flat ground going like slightly downhill. Like I got the canoe on my back, but it's not terribly heavy compared to a, you know, like a big mountaineering pack, etc. So like I'm like really chipper. I'm having a great time. Meanwhile, like Braxton doesn't know what the hardest thing he's ever done is. So he shows up and he's learning that the hardest thing he ever did is today. And when you don't have that, like that, you know, mental fortitude built up of how hard something's going to be, he was, you know, on the other hand, just getting kind of morally crushed. And, my chipperness was not helping his morale by any means. I'm like trying to be like, it's not so bad, you know, it's all good. But, you know, as someone who's went on expeditions, there's times when you need that. And there's times when your buddy tells you like, man, things are going great, when you want to be like, dude, just shut up. Like, I need to suffer for a while. So, you know, he's going through that experience and learning what the hardest thing he ever did was. And the difference between that day early on and later in the trip when we're walking and he has the physical fitness, but also like he knows he did 18 miles before, 12 miles today, like that's nothing, you know? So like building that mental resiliency is in a lot of ways everything when it comes to doing hard things.
Yeah, of course. I mean, you know, that's... it's kind of rule 101, isn't it? Is your brain will quit before your body does, long time before your body does. So just hang on, you carried a canoe 18 miles.
That ended up being our second longest. So our longest was 24. It was at the, like, our last section of the gorge. Yeah. And believe it or not, the 18-mile day was way harder. We were fit from walking the canoe. We were, you know, used to it both mentally and physically. And the 18-mile day was much tougher than the 24-mile day.
I mean, I think that's part of why your supported element makes like so much sense, because if you were traveling 18 miles with everything and you've got, you know, 50, 55 days of food and all your camp gear and everything to stay alive, like it's almost, well, it wouldn't be doable in a wanna. So you'd have to go 18 miles there with the stuff, jog 18 miles back, then do another run. Like that's a whole different style of trip.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, like, the logistics of that style of trip are a lot different, you know, like they just are. And, it, you know, there's a ton of value in that. In some ways, I wish we had done a truly self-supported trip. But in a lot of ways, I'm really happy we didn't, you know, like our ethics, like I said, were that the canoe was going to move downhill with just us. And whenever possible, we were going to haul as much of our gear, you know, in the water, we were definitely hauling it. If there were, you know, shorter portages, a lot of times we were hauling it, etc.
Yeah, it's wild. Well, you know, you're a young man. You've got a lot of expeditions left in you to go fully unsupported.
I hope so.
So, a kind of cheesy question, but like, what did you learn about the river, you know, through this journey?
Man, the amazing thing that I really learned is just, well, so I could say so many little things that I learned from all these people, like I said, that we were talking to, but I think the overall thing that I learned that was like the biggest takeaway for me is just how connected these river systems are. You know, we talk about truly that, you know, you pour some water in at the Continental Divide and it flows to the, you know, to the ocean. But like that's in reality what we did. And we're seeing a lot of the same like types of animals and types of fish on day, you know, 3 that we are on day 52. You know, the we don't see any ocean life until we get all the way to our last day. And all of a sudden we're seeing seals instead of river otters. But, you know, 2 days prior to that, we had already seen, you know, we'd been seeing the same types of river otters that we'd been seeing since we had first started on this trip. And the connectivity of these river systems is truly incredible, you know. Yes, there's damming and breakups now, but, you know, these animals don't know that. You know, they've been there for thousands of years, millions of years, however long. And, you know, we've kind of went as a society that our highways are our connected systems, but our rivers are just as connected.
Yeah, totally. I mean, it's one of the most natural, pure ways to travel when you really reflect on it, isn't it? You know, that's, I don't know how old the oldest canoe is, but it's old.
Yeah, exactly. You know, people have been building boats for rivers since there's been people, you know?
Yeah. Incredible. So I don't often ask this question, but I am of you because you do a lot of stuff and, you know, you're young. Like, what are your plans? What do you want to do now?
I don't have any huge expeditions set now. Like I said, my passions are usually in the mountains. You know, I loved the trip and the expedition, but I didn't actually like gain this incredible love of the act of canoeing itself, you know? So most of my passions and my desires still are with, you know, my hands on ice tools in the mountains or, you know, with skis on my feet. And recently, I've been kind of getting that desire to adventure back. You know, after 52 days, you'd think maybe it would take 52 days to get your desire back. But like, it took most of the summer. Last summer, I didn't really have the desire to go climb at, you know, farther away places. Or, you know, if I was going to climb, it was going to be a little bit, it was going to be fun. It was going to be, you know, at the sport crag instead of a long way away. So I've started to get more recently, believe it or not, just that, you know, we finished last July, but now is when I'm starting to get that pull back to those things as far as bigger trips go.
Yeah, it's like the itchy feet thing. It seems like there's no science to it. Like sometimes you come back from a major trip and you're like, I want more, give me more. But often it's like a month later or 3 months later or sometimes a year later where you go, okay, I'm done with comfort now. I need some more. It seems like there's no rhyme or reason to it.
Yeah. And you know, I think it just depends on your experiences on that trip. You know, every person gets a different experience from every trip, but every trip is different for every person as well. You know, so there's some unique experience that you had on that trip that, you know, for some reason triggers something in your mind of how long you need to wait before all of a sudden you have that desire to go do something big again.
Yeah, totally. It's an amazing story. I don't think I've spoken to many people who have completed a major journey they dreamed about when they were a child.
Yeah, you know, and it was really a cool thing for me, you know, to have been. We weren't very old when me and my cousins would put those boats in the river, right? You know, we're pretty young. And actually, we were on the other side of the Continental Divide, so those boats would float down the Mississippi to the Atlantic Ocean, and we'd put letters in them when we were kids. We always wanted somebody to write us back, and nobody ever did, but it was just this idea of that mixed with a love that my father had taught me of, you know, adventure and the mountains and, you know, trips like Lewis and Clark's and river travel and things like that, that are really, you know, ingrained in me. And that's what made me later a mountaineer, you know, mix that up with the love of skiing that I had. And that's how I became a mountaineer. But this trip was something that had been on my mind for so long, but I never really knew that it would be that valuable or that important until, you know, like I said, someone who inspires me tells me that it's valuable and important. And that made me realize, like, not just the value to me, but the value we could have for others on, you know, a personal level, whether it's connecting with someone, or the value we could have, you know, hopefully some small impact for an ecological impact.
Yeah, amazing. Well, I always ask the same two questions at the end of every conversation. The first is, what scares you?
Oh, for me, what really scares me generally is a lack of control, you know? So to me, what's less scary in the mountains, for example, is not whether I'll make the wrong decision or not. What's scary is, you know, the overhead hazard that I cannot control. You know, these factors that are risks that need to be, you know, limited or mitigated, and that I won't be able to have an impact in. And that's what, you know, what scares me for myself, or generally like larger fears. When I think of like a loved one dying, what's really scary to me is that I would be able to, you know, I could have prevented it, but I wasn't able to, or that I wasn't there to impact the outcome of something that I cared about or something that I loved.
And what brings you hope?
Man, I think what brings me hope is just in general, the people who inspire me, you know, like I said, for one example, you know, this kid Ty inspires me like no other, because he has no use below his shoulder at all. Like, he has a little use of one shoulder and his neck and mouth, and that's it. And this person, you know, if I was in his situation, I don't know that I could have the kind of strength that he does. Yet every time I talk to him, he is incredibly positive. I mean, he builds and designs things. He has a family now. He works a full-time job. He designs t-shirts. He loves to do all kinds of things. And every day he's excited. And, you know, he talks about having this idea that every day, every human, no matter what your situation, has two choices, whether to stay in bed or whether to get out of bed and face the day. And like, if he can think like that based on everything he's gone through, like, I can go through anything. You know, I am able-bodied. I have so many gifts that have been given to me physically, but also, like, you know, through the people around me and through love and the opportunities I've had. And with all my gifts, if other people who have it worse are able to, you know, build such an amazing life for themselves, not just him, you know, all kinds of people. And if they can do that, then I can do anything that I want to do.
That's amazing. Thank you. We'll leave it there.
Hey, thank you so much. I appreciate your time.
Thanks for listening. If you want to get in touch, then you can email me at matt@terraincognita.studio. And finally, as always, please do leave us an honest review on iTunes. They're a big help, and it really does help us bring the podcast to a wider audience.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Welcome back to Two Judgy Girls. I'm Mary from the Bay.
And I'm Courtney from LA. TJG is the podcast where we spill all the tea on your favorite reality TV shows, celebrity gossip, and everything in between. We're here to bring you our unfiltered opinions, hilarious commentary, and plenty of laughs along the way.
We're two SDSU Delta Gamma sisters with a microphone and a whole lot of opinions. Each week, we dive headfirst into the wild world of reality television, from Bravo to all the trash TV you could want. We break down the drama, dissect the latest scandals, and share our thoughts on everything from the jaw-dropping moments to the embarrassing antics.
But that's not all. We're not here to just gossip. We're here to connect with you, the jurors, and share our love of all things pop culture. Whether we're dishing on the latest celebrity breakups, discussing our favorite guilty pleasure movies, or sharing embarrassing stories from our own lives, we promise to keep it real, keep it fun, and keep you coming back for more.
Come judge with us.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.